Okay, we're on page 930. We didn't really finish. Okay, we're going to start sentence 29, closer to the end of the page. But there are a few issues here that we didn't finish up. Okay, basically the story is, if somebody kills somebody accidentally, so he has to run to the city of refuge, which were altogether 48 cities of refuge that protected the person. If the person goes out of the city, the avenger, which is the relative... Oh, you don't have chumash in there? Okay. Oh, they have.
Yeah, took it. She took
it. Okay, so the avenger, that means a relative of the one that was killed, has the right to kill the one that killed somebody accidentally, right? And he has to stay there until the death of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and then he's free. That's what we learned. So now, the question is like this. Is there ever a time that the murderer, again, accidental murderer, is able to leave the city of refuge? For instance, what happens if he's a witness in a murder case, and can he leave the city? When the Torah says you can't leave the city until the Kohen Gadol dies, and if you leave the city, you allow yourself to be killed by the avengers. The question is, what's the story? Okay? Now, the Rambam learns that if a person leaves the boundary city of refuge, he is allowing himself to get killed. That means he's just saying, okay, I don't care, I can get killed. If the guy kills him, it's no problem. And Rambam writes, you can't even leave the city of refuge to do a mitzvah. That's so strong, the not leaving the city of refuge. He says, even to act a witness in a court to save a person's life, or to save somebody from drowning, whatever. The bottom line is, you leave the city, no matter why you leave, you can leave for the holiest reasons. Bottom line is, the avenger could kill you. Huh? Also not. Same thing. Once you leave the city, no matter what the reason is, Rambam right, no matter what you're going for, you're giving yourself up for murder. Some opinions hold, no, we know a rule to save a life, all of the Torah's laws are suspended, unless the three sins of idolatry, adultery, and murder. So therefore, he is allowed to leave, okay? And therefore, then he shouldn't be able to be killed by the avenger, because he had permission to leave, because the Torah says, to save a life, you're allowed to leave the city. That's the second opinion. Another opinion says, and this is a very philosophical concept. One opinion says, Aruch HaShulchan says, the fact that something so bad happened through you, that you killed somebody accidentally, no good can come through you.
Bad luck. You're in the bad luck.
He says, bad karma. Yeah. In other words, the fact that something good might come from you, he said, can't be. Yeah. So therefore, he says, you're not allowed to leave the city. You want to leave the city, be able to have something good come through you. He says, it is unlikely that such an unfortunate person could be the one who would bring good fortune to others. Therefore, he writes, the Aruch HaShulchan writes, you're not allowed to leave the city. The Minchas Chinuch holds an interesting concept. He says, it's an illogical mitzvah, the Torah says you can't leave. That's it, finish. You can't leave, it does not because of this. The Torah says you can't leave. So these are various cases, basically, of what would happen if somebody would be needed to leave the city or not. So most opinions say you still cannot leave the city. Even though you need to save a life, you need to do something, the Torah says no. The Rebbe explains it a little bit deeper. And the Rebbe explains a nasich like this. He says, why can the avenger kill you? Why could the avenger kill you? And he says, if the avenger kills you, en lo dam, there's no blood. He's innocent. He says, the truth is, philosophically, you're a dead person already. Why is the law, think about it, you killed somebody accidentally, you're running to the city of refuge, the avenger, the relative of the one that got killed, is allowed to kill you. And the Torah says, "Ein loydam." There's no blood in his hands. He can just go and kill you if you're outside of the city, right? That means, the Rebbe explains, the Torah says you're really a dead person. And therefore, if you kill a dead person, nothing happens to you. But when you're in the city of refuge, you have a new lease on life. The cat has nine life. If when you're in the city of refuge, then you have a new life. Outside the city of refuge, you're dead.
You have the lease to move.
And therefore, if the guy kills you, so therefore you can't leave outside the city to do something good because you're dead.
You cannot do anything.
You can't do anything.
Interesting.
And it's an extremely philosophical concept. Yeah. You are really a walking dead. Because the Torah says, the fact that the Torah says the Avenger can kill you, and he has no blood, now you can't kill a living person. So obviously the Torah says you're not living. Because of the crime you did, really, ideally, you deserve to die. The Torah says, in the city of refuge, we're giving you a new lease on life. Outside of it, that's it. You're a dead person.
The lease is fire.
What?
When the Kohen Gadol dies, his mazal changes?
Yes. Yes.
Why did it?
And in fact, the Rebbe explained, what? Page 930, Pasuk Chavta. We didn't start it yet. We're just talking from that. Therefore, the Rebbe explains, remember we learned that words of Torah really is a city of refuge in a spiritual sense. Torah is a city of refuge for the Jew. And therefore, it says you cannot leave the city of refuge, for Torah is the very life of the Jew, which you cannot leave. You can't leave from your life. Like the famous story in the Gemara, when Rabbi Akiva, when the Romans decreed that you can't, during the end of the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple, the Romans decreed whoever is caught learning Torah is going to get killed. Rabbi Akiva kept learning. Akiva kept learning Torah. Mm-hmm. So students came to him and says, how could you learn Torah? You're risking your life. They're going to kill you. Mm-hmm. So Rabbi Akiva gave him the famous analogy, that a fox is once walking by the seashore and he saw in the water the fish were running back and forth. So he said to the fish, why are you running back and forth? So the fish answered, we're running from the fisherman's nets. Mm-hmm. So the fox, the cunning, the sly fox that he is, he says to the fish, why are you in the water and afraid running back and forth from the fisherman's nets? Come out on the dry land with me and you'll be safe. So the fish said to him, you foolish fool. this is why they call you the slyest of all animals. In the water, while we're in the water, this is our life. We have a chance of living and a chance of dying, of being caught. Once we leave the water, we're for sure dead. There's not much to talk about. We're for sure dead. I'd rather be in the water when we have a chance of survival than to be out of the water where we're for sure dead. And Rabbi Akiva said the same thing. For a Jew, Torah is the life. It's our life. You leave it, then you're dead. So the city of refuge, which we said, the Gemara says that the words of Torah are the protection of the city, the city of refuge, the person is actually saved and he's given a new lease of life in the city of refuge. Okay, let's go back to where we're up to now.
They work there, they have a job there, or they live in lifestyle, or they retire. How do they do that?
Depends on the age. Generally speaking, you're not allowed to retire under 150. You get 150 and you have a parent, then you can retire. In the city of refuge, they worked, they learned, whatever they did, they were able to do in the city of refuge. They lived it like a normal life. Except they had to be in the city, that's it.
Did you go with a family?
Huh?
All the family is coming?
It depends if he wanted the family and the family wanted him. But normally, the Gemara says his teacher was exiled to the city with him because a person needs to live there and he needs to learn Torah. So his Rebbe would go with him to the exile.
The Rebbe had to go?
Golan Rabbi Imei. The Gemara says, Golan Rabbi Imei. They made the teacher go to exile.
And if the Rebbe was gone to the city, then all the Talmudim had to go?
So whatever, I don't know exactly the technicalities of it, how it worked. But yeah, there was the concept that they had to go to the city refuge, and the person lived there a normal life. Okay, let's go.
If accident that is kill somebody in the city, what happened to him?
Then yeah, so the Gemara says, what happens if you accidentally kill somebody in the city of refuge?
Yeah.
You have to change neighborhoods. That's what it says. You have to. The Gemara says that the Marcus. You have to go to a different neighborhood.
Another city? Mm.
No, yeah. A different neighborhood in the same city. Yeah. Because again, you have to go to city of refuge, but you're already in the city of refuge. So it says you have to change neighborhoods. You have to go from to Beverly Hills, from LA. Different neighborhood.
Good side.
Okay, Pasuk Chof Tes, Pasuk 29. Okay, so the Pasuk is saying, you stay there until the Kohen God, the thousand son. These shall be for you a decree of statutes, for all your generations. In all your communities. Okay, so Rashi says it means that the laws of the courts exist inside of Israel, outside of Israel. The laws of the court are the same. Komaki nefesh. Okay, this pasuk says like this: whoever kills a soul again accidentally, lefi eidim. Well, no, lefi eidim. If there was based on the testimony of witnesses, yirtzech asadisech, then you kill the murderer. Okay, so like we learned, if there are witnesses and he was warned that you can't kill somebody, and the person killed somebody being warned by witnesses, and they saw it, so then they kill the murderer. He doesn't go to the city of refuge, he gets killed. Ve'ed echad, but one witness, lo ya'ana b'nefesh lomus, cannot testify against the person to die. Now, this is a very interesting fundamental law in the Torah, and that is that capital punishment can only be given by two witnesses. If you have one witness, no matter how great the witness is, does not the person does not get capital punishment. That means if Moshe Rabbeinu saw somebody murder somebody, and there's no question that it happened, and he's testifying that it happened, nevertheless, there's an illogical halach in the Torah, and that is you don't kill based on the testimony of one witness.
Why?
I said illogical. All the laws of testimony in Torah are completely illogical. We said last time bunch of things. For instance,
judge. If you judge somebody,
what's better, two witnesses or 100 witnesses?
100.
Equal.
I think it's 100.
Well, you would think 100 witnesses is better than two witnesses, right? But the Torah says, once you have two witnesses, today, kameya, two and like 100. If two witnesses say A killed B, okay, and 100 witnesses say no, A didn't kill B, C killed B, okay? So who do you have? You would think it's 100, but the Gemara says it's illogical, what's called Xeris Akosif, it's completely illogical. The 2 and the 100 cancel each other out, you have no witnesses. And therefore, nobody gets killed. Is it logical? No. Logically, 100 people are better than 2 people. Okay? Again, 2. If you have 1, 1 cannot give capital punishment. Not only that, lashes, those mitzvahs, those sins that you get lashes for, 1 witness cannot get you lashes either. Okay? Another law, which we learned also, discussed recently, if you have 100 witnesses, and out of the 100, 2 are related to each other, all 100 are null and void. And the question is, 1 minute. We still got 98 kosher witnesses. Okay, 2 are relatives, they're not kosher, right? Relatives are not kosher witnesses. I have 100 witnesses, 2 of them are relatives, yeah? So I'm left with 98. The din is, and again, illogical. The Gemara uses the expression, Eidus shebatl miksasa, batl kula. If part of the testimony of the witnesses is null and void, then all of them are null and void. And that's why we learned, when you go to a chuppah, when you go to a wedding, they designate the witnesses to watch the ring giving. Why? Because under the chuppah you have a father and a brother and this and that, all the non-kosher relatives. Right? And they're watching the ring giving. So then they're going to disqualify all the witnesses. So by designating the witnesses, especially if you add to the exclusion of all others, you don't even have to say that really. If you say, I'm designated A and B as witnesses, that means nobody else is testifying. They can look, they can see, but they're not witnesses, only A and B are witnesses. And therefore it doesn't matter, C, D, E, F, G are relatives.
So you could do it in this case also, witnessing a crime. If 100 saw it, designating
1 minute. If 100 saw the crime and two are relatives, the relatives just don't go.
Oh. Then you're okay.
If Moshe and Aaron, who happen to be brothers, nice guys, nice Jews, never lied in their life. I mean, not that I know of. Moshe and Aaron, if they saw a murder, what did they do? If they come to court to testify, they're relatives, they're no good. Right? So what happens? One of them goes and one goes home. One goes to testify, right? And the other one goes home. So when he comes to court, he's one witness. Then hopefully there's another witness. So combined to the first witness, you only have two. What?
Why is it that you have witnesses at a chuppah? Why don't we have witnesses like on other occasions? Like if a baby has a brit, or if a kinyan aver, or if there's... Even other times, other occasions, or even let's say you're slaughtering an animal or whatever, what is it that you have to have witnesses then?
I'm going to ask you a threefold answer. Number one, there is a law. Sometimes, okay, let me go like this. Sometimes one witness is believed. Okay, there's a number of cases. Not in punishment cases.
Monetary.
In monetary cases, yeah, but also not completely. If I say you owe me $1,000, I say I lent you no documentation, right? You owe me I lent you $1,000. You owe me $1,000. So if I and you deny it, obviously, if you're not Jewish and you admit, so then you pay it. But if you're Jewish, you deny it. Which is the typical Jewish way of doing things. So then, I have no proof. Correct? If I bring two witnesses that you owe me the money, you have to pay me the money. That's a given. Correct? You have two witnesses, you owe me the money. That's why you have a document signed by two witnesses. Because sometimes the witnesses might die or go overseas. So when you have them in writing, it's a rabbinic decree. Because biblically, witnesses cannot write. They have to verbalize. Al pi shnayim edim. The Gemara says it has to be mipihem v'lei mipiksavim. It has to be from their mouth, not from their right. According to biblical law, witnesses cannot write testimony and send it into court. In monetary issues, the rabbi is allowed, because if I have two witnesses watching me lend you $1,000, and they might die or go overseas, then I'm not going to lend you any money. I might not have witnesses. So the rabbi is allowed in monetary cases to write a document that the two witnesses sign, and it's like the testifying in court later on that the loan took place. Okay, what happens though if I say you owe me $1,000, you deny it, and I bring one witness that you owe me $1,000. Now according to halacha, one witness cannot extract money. Only two witnesses can extract money. If I bring two witnesses, then you have to give me $1,000. If I bring no witnesses, no. Burden of proof is on me, not on you. And I have no burden of, I have no proof. So, what happens if one witness, in Jewish law I'm saying, if one witness testifies that you owe me $1,000. So what's the law? And this is a biblical, one of the three biblical oaths. You have to swear against the witness. That means if the witness says, you owe me $1,000, you have to swear that you don't owe me the $1,000, a biblical oath in court, and then you're believed. But if you're not willing to swear against the witness, then you have to pay me. But if you swear against the witness, so then you're believed. But again, the one witness does not extract money. That's very interesting. What happens if I say, you owe me $1,000, and you say, I don't remember. And I bring one witness that says, you do owe me the money. Now, you have to swear against the witness, correct? Mm. That means, what would you have to swear?
That you remember.
You can't swear, I don't remember, because you have to swear against the testimony of the witness.
But if you don't remember, you cannot swear.
Right. Right. Sure. Right. But I'm saying, technically, what would you have to swear? You have to say that you don't owe me the money. Mm. You can't swear that because you say, I don't remember. That's the famous Gemara in Bava Batra. Miteich she'eina yachol lishava mishalim. If you can't swear against the witness, then you have to pay. The Gemara tells an interesting story over there. I went into your house and stole a silver platter. It's called Naschad Rababa. I went into your house and stole a silver platter. And you say, "Why did you give me back?" You know. And you bring one witness that I stole it from you. Okay? And the court says, "No." So I said, "I didn't steal it. I took it from you. But it's mine.
Why?
I lent it to you. It's mine." So I bring, you bring one witness that I took it from you. Right? I admit I took it from you, but it's mine. So then you can't swear against the witness. Because what did the witness say? You took it. That means you would have to swear you didn't take it. But you can't swear you didn't take it because you said you did take it. So then the din is you have to give it back. But there's a more practical case, by the way. And there's an interesting concept. You go into somebody's house to eat. You go home to eat. Yeah? It's for the women to know. Your husband comes home to eat. And let me ask you a question. How does he know the food is kosher? What proof is there that the food is kosher?
Trust.
The woman is one witness, and she's a woman that's not a kosher witness. So how can you trust? No, this is talking a lot. Interesting. No, it's a kagufi. Eid echa nemen bisurin. When it comes to Issa and Heter, allowed and not allowed, one witness is believed. And therefore, it doesn't even have to be a kosher. Like a woman, technically, the Torah, again, illogically. But there's another illogical law, that women cannot be witnesses in court. And it's contrary to American opinion. But according to Torah law, a woman cannot be a witness. Okay? In monetary issues, she's not believed. Or if a woman saw a murder, she's not believed. But when it comes to Issa and Heter, just like a woman is believed to say she went to the mikvah, a woman is believed to say that the food is kosher, or that she shechted the meat, or something like that. Yeah? In all these cases, eid echa nemen bisurin. Then, a woman is believed.
A man also?
A man, yeah, sometimes a man. He believed that he made a mess. That's about it.
So how come this case is believed and other cases not believed?
Because the Torah said, we learned enough from Saita, the eid einba, that the Gemara said, mikan she'eid echa nemen bisurin, that one witness is believed when it comes to Isser and Heter. But the Torah over here is saying that when you kill somebody, in order to have witnesses, you need two witnesses with all the ramifications. Two male, not related, you know, all the classifications of what a kosher witness is. And then the Torah says, one witness cannot kill somebody. But there are times in Torah that one witness is believed.
So in the kosher food, you believe one witness is okay?
You have it in a restaurant. You have somebody called a mashgiach.
There's one shot.
Yeah? Yes. I'll never forget, many years ago, before I got married, a long time ago, we went at the release time, you know, Wednesday afternoon in New York, you teach the kids in public schools. So we were talking about mashiach once. So one of my friends asked his class, did anybody hear ever of mashiach? So finally a kid raises his hand and says, yeah, that's the guy in the butcher shop. He meant the mashgiach. The mashgiach. Now, you go to a restaurant, yeah, there's a mashgiach. What's the purpose of the mashgiach? What's the purpose of a mashgiach?
A witness.
Believing that people don't think about it. The purpose of a mashgiach in a butcher shop, in a restaurant, in a whatever it is.
Witness.
He is testifying that the food's kosher. That's why you're allowed to eat it.
Doesn't have to check it
How can he testify the food's kosher if he's not checking it? He is testifying that
check.
The food is kosher.
Supposed to
he's
check.
Supposed to check. He doesn't make it kosher. Oh, by the way, I didn't answer your question about Kedushin yet. I still didn't answer your question. But we got sidetracked. A Mashgiach is actually a witness testifying that the food is kosher. That's what it is. It's only one witness, he's not two. The answer is, Eid Echad Nemen B'Yisun. When it comes to kosher and treif, one witness is believed. Now, you ask the question, why by marriage do we need witnesses, and why don't we need a bris, circumcision to have two witnesses to testify that the kid is circumcised? Or like, whatever. There's two types of witnesses. There are witnesses that are called Eidei Birur. They verify that something happened. And this is called Eidei Kiyum. They make it happen. Okay, for instance. Said before, if I come to you and say you owe me $1,000. I say I lent you $1,000, you owe me $1,000. And you agree. Do we need witnesses?
No.
If everybody agrees, do we need witnesses?
No.
No, right? Hello? What do you mean? If I say you owe me $1,000, just yes, I do.
Before we said that a person can say, I don't remember, and this and that.
I'm saying if you say, yes, I do.
Okay. Yeah,
if you don't remember,
yeah. See, then you don't need witnesses, okay. Right? That's a given. It doesn't happen too often that people agree like that. But if I say you owe me $1,000 and say yes, do we need witnesses?
No.
No. Now, what happens if a man and a woman go into a room? Nobody's in the room. The man gives the woman a ring. It says, Areat Mekudeshesli, you are consecrated to me with this ring according to the laws of Moses in Israel. Yeah? And they go out of the room, and he says it happened, and she said it happened. Are they married?
No.
Why not?
No witnesses.
But everybody agrees.
Both of them, they are married.
They all agree.
Both of them agree.
Because those witnesses of divorce and kedushin, the way the Ragat Shavah, this whole machlekes, the way we hold, like the Ragat Shavah, he holds the witnesses are part of the process. Most witnesses verify that it happened. They verify the loan took place. That if I say yes and you say no, so the witnesses verify what happened. They don't make the loan. They verify that the loan took place. Witnesses of marriage and divorce, Gittin and Kedushin, they make it happen. In other words, just like you need to, the man needs to give the woman a ring and say, I am Kedushinly, you need to have two witnesses there. Not to verify it, because if it would only be to verify it, everybody agrees, then what do you need it for? And the Gemara says clearly, even if everybody agrees, Ein Cheshish in the Kedushin, there's not even a Cheshash, there's no Kedushin at all. Because those witnesses, it's a unique, those two sets. Only, by the way, only by those two things. By divorce and marriage, the witnesses are part of the process of making it happen. They're not verifying it happened. When two witnesses testify on a murder case, they're not making the murder happen. They are verifying that the murder happened. And the Torah says, you need two witnesses. By the way, it's very interesting. There's a whole, in modern debate. Do you know, according to Allah, DNA is no proof? According to Torah law, you cannot prove a murder from DNA. Some people will probably soon disagree with this, but basically, the Torah says, you can only kill somebody for murder if there are two witnesses seeing the murder and testifying that it happened. If you can prove it with DNA, it's not valid according to Torah law. What better proof is there than DNA? The bottom line is, the Torah says, you need two witnesses that warned the person and saw it happen. And therefore, even with this one witness, the Gemara says, if you see Reuven chasing Shimon into a room, okay? Reuven is chasing Shimon into a room with a knife. And Reuven, and they both go into a room, and Reuven comes out of the room with a bloody knife. and you go into the room and you see Shimon's dead. In halacha, that circumstantial evidence, you cannot kill the Reuven for killing Shimon, because you don't have two witnesses. It's only circumstantial. What makes something uncircumstantial validating it? The Torah says, illogical, I'll be Shnayim Eidim. And that's why we learned last time. If somebody comes to court and says, I just killed somebody, you don't believe him. In secular law, it's the best proof, admission of guilt. In Torah law, if somebody says, I ate pig, give me lashes, you don't. If somebody says, I just killed somebody, and you see a guy dead on the floor, and he's holding a bloody knife,
After that.
You can't kill him. Because the Torah said, even if you could prove him the DNA on the knife and the blood with everything you want, according to Torah law, you don't kill him.
He goes free.
A fingerprint or something?
He goes free.
If they
you don't have proof, what are you going to do?
He goes free.
Yeah?
That's ADQ?
No.
No. If DNA, if it was, I could be ADQ.
There's no DNA, so it doesn't mean ADQ made a beer.
No. I mean, it's
a DNA is not a testimony.
I know it's not, but eventually, if somebody wants a halacha, then come and say, it's a part
it's
of
It's not going to happen so fast.
It's not?
Yeah.
So, where in the world is this going on? Where, it, or is...
What?
Is this reality or not a reality? I mean, there's
which the, part of it? I spoke a lot.
Like, there's the, you know, the world that we live in, and those rules don't apply. But
these laws applied in the time of the temple, when the rabbinic court ruled the land. Then, because even during, midway through the second temple, capital punishment in Jewish law was abolished. So in Torah law, there's no capital punishment already since the middle of the second temple. There's an interesting debate in contemporary halachic opinions if Jews are for capital punishment in the secular court system or not. That's another debate with a lot of written on it.
Why was it abolished?
Because the witnesses were lying and they the whole world was messed up and they didn't have the ability to do it.
What's the significance, though, of keeping these laws alive to talk about them over and over again? And I don't mean it in a way where they're not important. I really want to know if they don't apply anymore.
They don't apply as far as capital punishment is concerned, but they would apply the monetary laws. If I take you to Jewish court even, and I have two witnesses that you owe me the money, then they're going to make you pay it. If I don't have two witnesses, then the burden of proof is on me. If you have no documentation.
Where's the Jewish court?
The capital punishment was never applied.
In midway through the second Beis Hamikdash.
Because Rabbi Akiva was doing everything.
That's what Rabbi Akiva said. If I would be on the best, nobody would ever get killed. Because it would make the witnesses so crazy that, and that we also learned from here. Last week we learned v'shavtu eda, v'itzilo eda. They should judge and save. You have to find the way that the person should be saved. And therefore, we said last week, if you remember, the minimal court for giving capital punishment is 23, right? If 23 say guilty, you don't kill them.
Innocent.
You need at least. If everybody says guilty, something's wrong. That's what the Torah says. So in order to kill somebody, you need at least 13 and 10, because you need a majority of at least 2. So if 13 say guilty and 10 say innocent, you kill them. Yeah? If 15 say guilty and 8 say innocent, you kill them. If 22 say guilty and 1 says innocent, you kill them. If 23 say guilty, you don't kill them. Well, there's a logic, because it can't be that nobody could find Vitzilu, because then they didn't have Vitzilu. They didn't find favor. They didn't save him.
That applies only to Jews.
Yeah. By the way, the Rambam writes at the end of Hilchos Melachim, when the Jews controlled the Goyish systems in Israel, the non-Jewish systems, a Goy could be killed by one witness. This is on Torah law for Jews, there has to be at least 2 witnesses.
For Goyim, it's not fair.
It's not fair? Life is not fair. Since when is life fair?
But the person that gets off because of the laws, but they did do the deed.
God kills them different ways.
Okay, so that's my question. The
God will kill him.
Okay, so it's not our business. It's just, God will handle him and that's it.
We have enough of our own headaches. Let God run the world the way he wants to. And let him help the headaches. Yeah, we said that what's going to happen one day is the intentional murderer is going to be at the bottom of a ladder and somebody's going to fall on top of him and kill him accidentally, and he's going to get his punishment anyway, eventually.
Same thing with the monetary thing you were talking about, like if there's not a witness or whatever.
Let me tell you something. God, in case we didn't know, God runs the world, whether we like it or not.
Yeah? He knows how to do it.
God runs the world in the best possible way, whether we like it or not. Right? If I owe you money, and I just can't prove it, I mean, you can't prove it, and I get off the hook, you know what? God has a lot of ways for making me lose $1,000.
Easy.
You know what I mean? God can make a leafy roof. God can make a medical bill. God has his ways of running the world. Nobody gets off. You know what? The way Hashem runs the world, if you're guilty,
you have to pay that.
You're going to get it somewhere. You know what I mean? It's like, we're way off topic, but let's continue already off topic. There's a contradiction between two Talmudic sayings. One saying is, in Rosh Hashanah, the amount of money we're judged and how much money, and Rosh Hashanah is decreed how much money we're going to have for the year. Okay? And it says, all the money called Heitzaesef Shel Adam Ksuvim Leim Rosh Hashanah, except the Heitzaesef Shabbos and Yom Tov. Except the expense of the Shabbos and Yom Tov, that's not counted in the budget at the beginning of the year. The more you spend for Shabbos and Yom Tov, God gets you back. Gives you back. But the budget for the year, God decides for us on Rosh Hashanah. Another Gemara says, we're judged every day. So, how does it work? One of the many answers is very interesting. Let's say on Rosh Hashanah, God decides you're going to get $100,000 for the year. Let's say, right? Years ago, we used to say $10,000. Now, you get $100,000 for the year. Huh?
$200. It's not bad money. It's
now, so Rosh Hashanah, God says you're going to get $100,000 for the year. But how that money is going to be spent, that we're judged every day. You know, God can give us $100,000 for the year that we have to pay all the bills, plus we can go on vacation. And sometimes God can give us $100,000 a year, and then we ended up paying 50,000 medical bills and 10,000 leaky roofs. That's what we're judged every day, how the money is going to be spent. But you understand? So God is his way. If you owe money, don't think if people cheat in business, which is common practice, if you cheat in business, then you're going to make more money. Initially, you might be thinking you're making more money, but you know what? If God wants you to have the money, you're going to get it. If God doesn't want you to have the money, it doesn't matter by hook or by crook. That money, you're going to lose in a different way. There was an older chassid. He died at 100 years old. He wrote a book, Sabato, Leis Ananas. He was in Siberia for tens and tens of years. I mean, a Russian Jew, a Chabad guy that was, and he came out to America. Anyway, so when he came out to America, he had a problem with his foot. He had a problem with his foot. So he went to a specialist in Manhattan, okay? And he was a Russian Jew. He came up broke. He had no money. What did he have already? The guys came up from Russia, nothing. And the guy charged him a pretty hefty price. So he was thinking to himself, should I bargain with the guy or not? And then he said to himself, and this only a chassid can think this way. He said, I'm not going to bargain with the doctor. He says, why? It's destined by God how much money I'm going to spend on medical bills this year. Right? God has a budget. How much I'm spending on medical bills. And let's say it's $10,000 for the year, yeah? And this guy's asking me $10,000. If I bargain with him to get five, I'm going to have to go to a doctor again to pay the other five because God is saying me a $10,000 medical bill. Let me pay it now. And be finished with it. So he decided he's not going to argue with the doctor or negotiate with the doctor. He said, because you know what? Whatever it is, it's destined. You cheat in business, you lose the money another way. I mean, You kill somebody intentionally. God runs the world. You know what I mean? God forbid you're going to die a different way. You're going to get sick a different. Whatever it is, it's going to happen. Whatever is going to happen is happening. In that, we have no free choice. We have a only free choice in good and bad of mitzvahs and not mitzvahs. That's it.
Indeed.
Everything else is not free choice. Everything else is destined. How much money we're going to make is destined. How the money is going to be spent is destined. We think we have a say in the matter. We cheat. We make more money. It doesn't work like that. In Judaism, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, but today, doctors and others, whatever, charge you an arm and a leg.
They take your arm and a leg.
Yeah, no.
But if you say every day is a new day, so every day you are a different person and you can be a different person, how can... If it's a
so
new day,
today, can, God can make, the money will go for good things.
So that means you already planned, your future is... What's going to happen is planned.
God, everything, Hashem, it's Tzadik Gavur Konono, everything's planned by Hashem.
So you cannot change nothing.
Huh?
You cannot change
nothing. Davening can change things.
So
good deeds can change
still
things.
Still, cannot change.
The decrease of the money of the death can be changed right now.
So nothing is changed.
Yes or no?
While we're way off the topic, there's another contradictory Gemara. The Rebbe has five answers to the question in a letter. It's printed in the Kutasichas. One Gemara says that you're even allowed to get engaged to a person on Tisha B'Av. Because if you don't do it, maybe somebody else will grab them first. Maybe Hashem Yikadmenu Berachman. Maybe somebody will get the person, so if you don't get them, you might lose it out. Yet another Talmud says, 40 days before conception, it's already announced who's marrying whom. So if it's already predestined, so how could somebody else grab them away from me? It's destined for me. Yeah? And the Rebbe has five answers to the question. Not all the answers, but some are basically the same point in a different way. The bottom line is, it might be destined to be yours, but somebody else might get them, change it through davening. And as that answer says, it's possible for somebody to change the destiny through their davening. Another answer that Rebbe gives, basically, is you might get them, but you might lose them. In other words, somebody might get the person temporarily through davening, but then they're going to lose them, and you're going to get who you're destined to anyway.
So
you don't daven? Huh? No, the daven, whatever. I'm saying this is different ways. Coming back here before we finish, wrap it up. So the Torah says, Eid echad le'yana b'nefesh lomas. One witness, get into this whole thing. One witness cannot testify in death cap punishment. Even in monetary laws, the only thing one witness can do is cause the person to swear against the witness, right? Or in, like we said, Isurin, you know, a woman, let's say, goes to mikveh, and she comes home, she says, I went to the mikveh. How is she believed? Because the din is a woman is believed to say. The house is kosher. In her things of Isur and Heter, she's believed to say she did it. What?
Isn't the Isur and Heter more important? Being that kind of a witness more important in a way than...
But again, like we said before, it's all illogical. Hashem says, in this, one witness is believed.
No, I understand, but the fact that it's...
By the way, in non-kosher witnesses, one becomes believed like two, and then if one later says it's not true, you don't believe the one, because the one person who said it's kosher has a trust of two, and therefore he's not believed. It's funny laws.
But my point was, like,
what?
If a woman is believed